10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911 and newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com. The morning show starts in about 30 seconds.
July 20th, 2019 will mark the 50th anniversary of that extraordinary day when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the surface of the moon. One way to better understand that amazing achievement and how it was achieved is to take in hand a brand new book called First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. It is put together by Rod Pyle, a prolific science writer and historian with 13 books to his credit on spaceflight. He has also had a major hand in a number of different science documentaries related to the space program. In this book, Rod Pyle offers illuminating information on every aspect of the Apollo 11 achievement, including its historic context and what came after Apollo 11. And the book is replete with fascinating images, including photographs that have never been published before. The book is published by Sterling. Mr. Pyle, although this book is most valuable for all of the information it gives us about Apollo 11, I do appreciate the very personal note on which it begins. Tell our listeners just a quick word about how voraciously interested you were in all matters related to space as a youngster, and the frustration that you felt through the early 1960s in terms of how these events were covered and what was available to you.
So I was born the year before NASA was born. And when you grew up in that period of time, if you weren't absolutely enamored of football players and those kinds of heroes, the astronauts were your heroes, and they were certainly my heroes. So I followed this program voraciously throughout the late 60s and into the early 70s. And I think the frustration you're talking about, there are two sources of frustration. One was I'd go to my elementary school library and look for books on spaceflight and Apollo, and they'd have stuff like the Little Golden Book of Spaceflight from 1957, which looked like a cartoon. So that was frustrating. And then once we did accomplish these amazing lunar landings and these incredible missions, people got bored pretty quickly. And by the middle of Apollo 14, the TV stations and networks were cutting back to reruns of I Love of Lucy or soap operas. So it was a little frustrating leading up to it and certainly frustrating afterwards.
I am also struck by the fact that when you recount what it was like for you as a youngster to watch that first landing on the moon, you were choked up. and I would have expected your parents to be choked up, but not necessarily a young child to be for this to be that kind of emotional experience that it was for you.
I was just so stunned that it had worked. You know, I'd learned just enough, and I was probably 10 or 11 at the time, I learned just enough to realize how complicated and challenging this was. And this was 1960 technology, you know, 1969. We had just barely gotten handheld transistor radios and microwave ovens at that point. And here are these two guys landing on the moon in this fragile, delicate spacecraft. And I think it's really remarkable when you look back. We're almost as far now from the landing of Apollo 11 as it was from the first flight of the Wright brothers. So when you think of it in that context, it's just staggering. And I tell you what, I'll probably tear up when we make our next landing on the moon.
Related to the matter of technical limitations, I think one of the first times that became clear to me was in a documentary where I saw footage of astronaut wives in their living room, and you just saw the furniture and you saw the primitive TV with the rabbit ears on top, and you realized that is the world, that is the level of technology that got us to the moon somehow. How was such a thing possible? That's one of the things your book tries to explain.
Yeah, it is. And it's something I've been trying to explain since I started writing about space flight in the 1980s. It really is stunning. When you look back from the 50-year viewpoint now, it's kind of difficult to believe that it worked as well as it did and that we never lost a crew in space. We lost one on the ground. But during Apollo, we never lost a crew in space. It wasn't until the shuttle program that we had some accidents. It was the sheer domineering force of will. Kennedy had announced this program. It was largely geopolitical in nature. He just wanted to make the Soviet Union look bad, if possible, because we were falling behind in comparison to them, many people's eyes. But we took this technology that was really rooted in the post-war aerospace industry in the 1950s, and out of it, we rung this 21st century program. And I'm telling you, in every single flight, they were right at the edge of what this technology could do. We had just graduated from vacuum tubes to transistors, and we were managing this. So the fact that it's taking us this long to get back is really kind of stunning from today's perspective.
Right. I appreciate how clearly you write about many of the technical matters related to Apollo 11. And that had to be, that's no small feat, because some of this is incredibly complicated material that you really do a great job of making clear for us. I'd love to hear a little bit from you about specifically the lunar module and the chapter which you devote to the lunar module itself. This would be the craft that actually took Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin down to the surface of the moon and then brought them up again. You write at the beginning of this chapter, the Apollo lunar module was just enough of a spacecraft to do its job. What do you mean by that? Explain those intriguing words.
So this was a separate spacecraft that was designed to fly only in space. It was really the world's first spaceship. And all it had to do was take them from lunar orbit down lunar surface and back up to lunar orbit. And then the rest of it was done by the Apollo command module, the capsule, if you will. That sounds simple, but because of the weight constraints, the Saturn V rocket could only lift so much weight. Because of the design constraints of the era, this early 1960s technology, the lunar module had to be incredibly light. And to do that, the manufacturer, Grumman, had this struggle from 1962 to 1968 when they finally got it finished just in the nick of time, to the point that they were literally scraping down every surface, trying to remove any extra solder that they could where the wires connected with the instrumentation. Any ounce, any gram that they could remove, not only was gladly done so, but they were actually paying their employees, whether you were an engineer or a chemist or a janitor, they didn't care. If you could help find a way to remove a gram or two from that spacecraft, you got a bounty in the thousands of dollars. So it was a titanic struggle to the point that they were actually milling down little components with acid just to make them slightly thinner on a molecular basis. If you ever get a chance to go up and look at a lunar module and touch it, you'll discover that much of that hull where the astronauts rode down in, which is very small, was little thicker than a Coca-Cola can. So it was really a marvel of engineering.
It really was. And you end your chapter by saying, in the end, the lunar module was the only major component of the Apollo system that never suffered a noteworthy malfunction in flight, a testament that Tom Kelly and his thousands of associates could be proud of. I appreciate the fact that we get to know all three of the Apollo 11 astronauts in your book. And what I think was most revelatory to me was the personality of Michael Collins, the one astronaut who didn't actually, get to the surface of the moon. He's actually a very lively presence in this trio, and I can scarcely imagine Apollo 11 without him, even though he's the astronaut that we tend to think of last and think of least.
Yeah, he was a real raconteur. You know, Neil Armstrong was kind of quiet and taciturn, not as much so as represented in the movie First Man. He actually had a very dry wit and a good sense of humor, but he was very quiet and studious. Buzz Aldrin was very intense, very engineering-minded, thinking in the world of equations and so forth all the time. But Michael Collins was the easygoing, quick with a joke, easy to laugh. As he put it about his crew, they were amiable strangers. They got along well enough, and they did everything as a perfectly welded team, but they couldn't have been more different in terms of their personalities. And Collins is the connoisseur of fine wine. He still does watercolor paintings. He loves fine food. So he was just really kind of this sort of gentleman in the classic mold amongst this batch of test pilots. So a very fascinating man.
And you take actually a moment in the book to share with us the thoughts of a son of Buzz Aldrin and a son of Neil Armstrong. And that's a very interesting perspective to get as well. In our final couple of minutes, though, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about at least some of the things that one sees in this book that have very likely never been seen before, certain documents, certain photos. And one of my favorites, by the way, is a color photo from the surface, looking down at the surface of the moon, in which we see the footprints of the astronauts. So this is after they have done their historic moonwalk, and there's the flag right in the middle. It's an amazing photo I've never, ever seen before.
Isn't that one luscious? So I really wanted to dig into the archival material and try and get some material that either hadn't been seen or had been seen rarely. So as it turned out, back in the 1960s and 1970s, when NASA released the pictures in the Apollo program, they culled through these thousands of photos that were taken, both on the surface and in space, and pulled out the most pressworthy ones for obvious reasons. They wanted to look good, but most were left behind in the archives. So unless you went and got on your hands and knees and dug around the archives, as I have done a few times, you didn't see these things. But in about 2015, 2016, they did release another batch of these older photos. And a lot of them were an accidental shot of a boot or the horizon crooked or something. But there are many that were parts of panoramas that you can assemble into larger photographs, which is the one you're talking about. They're the ones on the orange bordered pages. So I hired a digital compositor to do this beautiful work, and he put together these wonderful assembly of these photos, bespoke just for this book. And they're just lovely to see, and it's exciting to me to be able to present them.
It's an amazing book, and I learned an awful lot about Apollo 11, and I went into this knowing a fair amount about it, but it's just such a complex and wondrous undertaking, and there is always more to learn, and your book is a tremendous resource for us as we look back 50 years. The book, again titled First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience, published by Sterling, a breathtakingly beautiful and fascinating book, and the author, Rod Pyle. Rod Pyle, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for writing this wonderful book.
Thank you so much. Take care.
I want to add that Rod Pyle's book begins with a very poignant foreword written by astronaut Buzz Aldrin, of course, one of the two men who actually walked on the surface of the moon during Apollo 11. And his book ends with these moving final words. In an interview in 2011, Neil Armstrong advocated for a return to the moon. "I favor returning to the moon," Armstrong said. "We made 6 landings there and explored areas as small as a city lot and perhaps as large as a small town. That leaves us some 14 million square miles that we have not yet explored." He added that this would allow engineers to practice a lot of the things that you need to do when you are going further out into the solar system. At the end of a 2005 interview about Apollo 11 for a television show, I asked Flight Director Gene Kranz if he had a final comment he would like to make. In most such interviews, the person in front of the camera says, "No, that's about it, I guess," but not Gene Kranz. He paused for a moment, then looked up at me with his steely missile man eyes and said with great conviction this simple but bold statement. What America will dare, America can do. I'm sure that Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins would strongly suggest that we dare again and honor the great and everlasting legacy of Apollo 11. The book begins with this lovely dedication. This book is dedicated to the nearly 500,000 men and women who made our first expeditions to the moon possible. You performed miracles in less than a decade. The book again is First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience, published by Sterling, the author Rod Pyle. I'm Gregory Berg. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. And now an exceptionally interesting book, which is called War as They Knew It. You really don't understand what this book is about until you read the subtitle. Woody Hayes, Beau Schembechler, and America in a Time of Unrest. I'm sure many of you know the names of Woody Hayes and Beau Schembechler. Woody Hayes, the legendary coach of Ohio State, Beau Schembechler at the University of Michigan. And they achieved such greatness during a time of enormous turbulence here in America. And it's so interesting when we think about those tough years, tension-filled years for our country. We don't often think of some of the things that were sort of in place that sort of stood at odds. But college campuses not only had protesters and demonstrators, but also had people like football coach Woody Hayes. And the clash between those cultures and perspectives and the way in which someone like Woody Hayes tried to ride the waves of changing times is really the heart and soul of this fascinating book by Michael Rosenberg, an award-winning writer for the Detroit Free Press. Perhaps you know his work from FoxSports.com. And he's the author of this book, which is published by Grand Central Publishing, again called War as They Knew It, Woody Hayes, Beau Schembechler, and America in a Time of Unrest. Michael Rosenberg, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Did anything in particular inspire you to examine these two men and the times in which they lived? I mean, did some sort of fact about their careers maybe jump out at you and set all this in motion?
You know, I knew a few tidbits. I knew that Woody Hayes had visited the troops in Vietnam four times, that he made a lot of comparisons between military strategy and football strategy. I knew he was a longtime friend of Nixon's from the 50s until the 80s when Woody died. I knew that he turned down pay raises. I knew that he had walked to work rather than drive because he was worried about America's reliance on foreign oil. And covering so many coaches today in my regular job, I was just fascinated by this. I thought, what an unusual guy. But on their own, those things were just kind of quirks. You know, I really had to do a lot of research to understand why he was like this and who he was. And the other thing that really stuck with me was I had heard that when Beau Schembechler arrived in Ann Arbor in 1969, obviously it was kind of a radical enclave at the time, and football was not very popular. It was seen as this establishment activity. And the idea of these two kind of conservative icons trying to make their way through the country as everything was going on around them from 1969 to 1978, such a tumultuous era, something about that told me that there was maybe a story there. And I worked on it for about 3 years and discovered that the story was actually far more interesting than I even imagined when I started my research.
Hmm. Let me ask you one question, just because I'm afraid I won't find the time to ask it, and I think it's an important question. As I read your book, one of the things that struck me was the tone with which you talk about many of the demonstrators and activists mm-hmm. in that time.
I sense, at least at some points, maybe a somewhat, I was going to say dismissive tone. I think that's maybe overstating it just a little bit. But, for instance, you particularly speak about a lot of the most radical sorts of demonstrators and in many respects sort of the most outrageous things that were done. I'm wondering if that's has something to do with your own perspective on that, or if you are trying to give us, in a sense, what probably the perspective was of somebody like Woody Hayes or a Bo Schembechler. I mean, trying to draw even sharper contrasts between these two clashing worlds. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, you know, I think one part of it is that just by choosing radicals, obviously I was choosing people that were on the far end of the spectrum. When you talk about Bill Ayers, who's in the book, and John Sinclair, Pun Plamundon, who formed a group called the White Panthers in Ann Arbor, I really was determined in this to kind of tell a story of what it was like in that era, kind of get you inside the heads of all these different people. And what fascinated me so much was that there were so many people in this book who cared desperately about their country and literally were willing to do anything they possibly could to secure their vision for the country. It's just that those visions clashed. They were just total opposites. And I really tried not to judge anybody. I mean, there's probably not one person in this book who I personally would agree with all of their politics and all of their methods. I mean, from Woody Hayes to Bo Schembechler to Richard Nixon to Bill Ayers to John Sinclair. But I felt like, you know what, just try to tell the readers a story. Just tell them what these people were thinking, what it was like. And, you know, some of these people literally wanted a revolution in America. And I was more concerned with what would make them think that, what would make them want it, than did it not work out or were they right or wrong. And obviously readers can come to their own conclusions.
Sure. And I think that ends up making this a tremendously compelling account. Among the many things you tell us about Woody Hayes, and I think you've maybe briefly touched on this already in talking about his visits to Vietnam and so on, that he was in so many respects a military man and, among other things, a passionate admirer for General Patton. Tell us just a little bit more about that and about the way in which that affected the kind of the way in which he coached.
Well, first of all, just sort of as an aside, Patton wrote his memoirs, which were called War as I Knew It. And I adapted that for the title of this book, War as They Knew It, because I really felt like the country was not only literally at war in Vietnam, but kind of at war with itself. And I'm always hesitant to use that football war metaphor, but I felt like in this case it applied largely because Woody made so many comparisons between the military and between war and football. He really idolized everything Patton did. I mean, he really literally modeled his program after how Patton ran his army. And one thing that appealed to him was Patton had the lowest casualty rate of any of the major generals in World War II. And Woody kind of aspired to that. I mean, it was a low-risk football. That's what he was doing. He wanted to pound people into submission. He wanted to do the same things over and over again. Year after year, his team was among the lowest in the country at penalties, at turnovers. So he really did model his program after how Patton ran the military.
Hmm. And, of course, he was someone who was so bewildered by events as they were moving in the 1960s. You quote him at one point as saying that he really missed the 1950s when the air was clean and sex was dirty.
Right. That's right. That's how I like it. I mean, it drove him crazy that people were openly talking about sex. You know, professors would talk about it. I mean, that drove him nuts. He really did kind of aspire to a simpler time, and I had a real empathy for that, and he just couldn't cope with what was happening around the country. And that's not to say that I agreed with everything he said, because I certainly didn't, but I appreciated how sincere he was and how concerned he was for what was going on.
Sure. You also paint us, I really appreciated the point that you picture paint for us a complex picture of a complex man who had a number of different interests and passions. And you say he had a deep desire to affect society. And you've said it's interesting that someone like that would devote his life then to coaching a game, when in a sense there were things that are much more important than games.
Right.
That were important to Woody Hayes.
That's right, and I did write that, and then I wrote that the thing is, to Woody, the question was flawed. He didn't see it as just a game. I mean, he really, and this was probably the key difference between Woody Hayes and Beauchamp Butler, in my opinion, was that Woody Hayes saw his program as a model for the country. So every time his football team's out there on Saturdays in the fall, he's thinking everybody in the stands, everybody watching on TV is going to see this hard-nosed, disciplined, militaristic unit, and they're going to appreciate it. And they're going to appreciate how they listen to their leader and do what their leader says. And that was everything to him. And now as the 60s are ending and we're going to, getting into the 70s and the war's becoming more unpopular, and then Watergate happens, it's becoming very clear the country is ignoring that model and almost mocking that model. And it really chewed him up. That is a big part of what happened to Woody Hayes at the end of his career, why he was kind of losing his grip, was because the country was ignoring kind of his life's work and almost mocking it.
Hmm. And one of my favorite lines in the whole book about Woody Hayes and who he was as a coach, and I suppose maybe in some ways as a man, you say, more than any other great coach in football history, Woody Hayes thrived on simplicity.
Yeah.
I guess, as a man, he was complicated in that he was interested in lots of different things. He was far more intellectual than we would maybe judge him to be on the surface or on the surface of it. But in fact, in terms of his approach to football and the game, there was a beautiful simplicity about it, which I think speaks to what you were just saying and the sort of statement he was trying to make to the country and maybe even the world.
Yeah, you know, one of his first national championship teams, I talked to a player named Daryl Sanders on the team. He said they had like 9 or 10 plays. I mean, that was their whole playbook was 9 or 10 plays. Everybody knew what was coming. When they wanted to throw the ball, it would be LeMay. That was their audible to throw the ball because Curtis LeMay, the Air Force general. So it was just the most obvious thing, but they won. They won the national title anyway because they just did it better than anyone else. It was just, we're going to do the same thing over and over again. You're going to know what's coming, and it's not going to matter. And what happened was, by the 70s, people are starting to innovate, and you can't win football games as easily that way. And he held on for a long time, but he retired in 78, was forced to retire. And if he'd coached in the 80s, it would not have gone well. He just wasn't capable of coaching the new way.
Hmm. Bo Schembechler is someone who has a fascinating history with Woody Hayes, that they begin in one relationship and move to another. So it's coach-player, then coach-assistant, and eventually to rival coaches in perhaps one of the greatest rivalries that college sports has ever seen.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, and these are two of by most standards, certainly when Bo retired, and even now I think two of the top 10 or 12 coaches in the history of the sport. I don't know of any other rivalry in American sports that has that many layers to the relationship between the coaches as these guys did. And just purely from a football sense, it's astounding how good those teams were. I mean, Michigan's average or their median rank entering those 10 games against Woody Hayes was 4 in the country. Ohio State's median rank was 4.5. So you're literally talking about two top 5 teams almost every year going after each other.
You paint a picture of two men who were in some ways strikingly different from one another, maybe particularly in certain personality traits, and yet who shared many similarities.
Yeah, they did have so many similarities, and that's really why they were close. I mean, they weren't the kind to share their feelings, but the reason Bo did so well on Woody's staff when he was an assistant was because he thought like Woody. And he thought like Woody enough to know not to question Woody sometimes because he knew he wouldn't have wanted to be questioned. So they did have those similarities. And I always say about Bo, it was like 98% of what he saw from Woody, he copied, just flat out copied. And the other 2%, he tried to learn his lesson and not repeat it. And I think that's why Bo Schembechler was able to have the career he did and able to have the reputation he did. And one thing that intrigued me doing this book is a lot of people think of Woody Hayes and Bo Schembechler as sort of two peas in a pod. I think you say Woody and Bo, nobody hesitates. And yet nationally, Bo Schembechler is beloved and Woody Hayes is kind of hated or mocked. And I was just so interested in why was that? What was that little difference that totally changed people's view on these two guys?
We're speaking with Michael Rosenberg, and we're talking about his book, War as They Knew It, Woody Hayes, Bo Schembechler, and America in a Time of Unrest. You've touched briefly on this, but let's talk for a moment more about Michigan itself and the fact that it was an exceptionally turbulent place as college campuses go. At one point, you say the university was a buffet of causes: racial harmony, sexual freedom, nuclear nonproliferation, Marxism, gay rights, and everybody seemed to pick at least one. The stunning part was the completeness of it all. Ann Arbor seemed like one city in which the establishment's power was truly limited.
Right.
And of course, to plunk down in the heart of all of that, a football team and an authoritarian coach is kind of an interesting picture.
Well, you know, the day before Boshin and Buckler's first game at the University of Michigan, the school president, Robin Fleming, told 5,000 students that the war in Vietnam was, and this is a quote, a colossal mistake. And his next quote, I think, is just as interesting. He said, "We have also the rather naive notion that our political institutions have served this country so admirably that they must be applied to every other country in the world." I mean, that's pretty radical stuff from a university president to say, you know, in 1969. And trust me, if that had been said at Ohio State, Woody Hayes would have gone ballistic.
Hmm.
But that was the kind of town Ann Arbor was. In 1968, somebody bombed a ROTC staff member's car. A couple of buildings were bombed. I mean, these weren't just, you know, bomb craters. These were actual bombs at the time. It was pretty scary stuff.
It's also fascinating, the picture you paint of how football players tended to be viewed at a place like Michigan. I mean, I think most of us think of football players as, generally speaking, the heroes on campus, or they can be. I mean, certainly not every single one. They can be a mixed bag, too. But just in general, that's somebody that you might look at across the way and with some degree of admiration, at least. And at a place like Michigan, in a time like 1970, that was, to a surprising extent, not the case at all.
Yeah, you know, when you're working on a book like this, at least for me, I was looking, especially in the beginning, for certain sort of nuggets, certain indications that I was having, I was onto something, you know, that there was a story here and that it was different from what had been written. And one of the first ones I got was Dan Dierdorf, who's one of the greatest offensive linemen ever, is in the NFL Hall of Fame and was on Michigan's team when Bo Schembechler arrived. He said he would not wear his letter jacket on campus because he did not want people to know that he was a football player. I mean, and just the thought of like a Ron Dane or a, you know, Anthony Carter, just anyone like that in later years, not wanting people to know that they're a football player is just crazy. But that's how it was at the time. I mean, several players said that they wouldn't tell their professors they were football players. They didn't want their schoolmates to know, their fellow classmates, because it was not cool. I mean, this was an establishment activity at the time. And that's just so different from now, and I really tried to kind of capture that era.
Hmm. Well, of course, one of the things which ensues, and in many respects kind of the heart and soul of your book, is the fierce rivalry which springs up between Ohio State and Michigan. And one thing that gives us a sense of just how heated this rivalry was the way in which Woody Hayes would refer to that other school.
Right, that school up north. And that was one of those things I'd heard before I started working on the book, that he would say that, and I was just sort of under the assumption that that was what he did with the media. I discovered, talking to people, literally nobody I talked to, of 100-some people who knew Woody Hayes, nobody could remember him ever saying the word Michigan, certainly in reference to the school. It was just that state up north, that school up north. When he wanted to watch film of opponents, he would say, "Get me the Indiana movies, get me the Wisconsin movies." When he wanted to watch Michigan, he just said, "Get me the movies," and everybody knew what he was talking about.
The Ohio State had, of course, been a great power for some time. Michigan, not so much. Under Bo Schembechler, of course, they turned things around. And so what has been called one of the great upsets in college football history occurs 1969, I think. The first time, I think, those two teams meet, with Hayes and Schembechler as the two coaches.
That's right, and it was just really the game that kind of started it all. I mean, and Bo had a couple of struggles that year, but his team had really played well going into that game. And Woody Hayes had a team that people were saying was the best in the history of the sport. It was the 100th anniversary of college football. Dan Jenkins in Sports Illustrated wrote that Ohio State looks like number one and also number two and number three. I mean, they had that kind of depth. And so for Bo Schembechler to pull off this upset of the team of the century in Michigan Stadium in 1969, was incredible. And sort of as a side note to that, which I really think speaks to how intense this rivalry is and what Woody Hayes was like, he had there was a rug made up that had that score, U of M 24, OSU 12, and he put it in the Ohio State locker room, and the players had to walk across it every single day for the next year until they played Michigan.
You're right. Never again would a Woody Hayes team be accused of taking Michigan lightly. Hayes had the 1969 score woven into a rug along with a blank score for the 1970 matchup. He then laid the rug at the door of the Buckeyes locker room where they would have to walk over it every day.
Yeah, you talked about trying not to look ahead to an opponent. That was not Woody's concern. He was looking ahead a year.
By the way, you point out something that I think is so interesting. You say many of the biggest upsets in sports only seem like big upsets at the time. They
right.
follow a certain formula. The favorite has been winning for so long, nobody considers the possibility of a loss. Meanwhile, the underdog is far better than it is perceived to be. In 1964, nobody could imagine Cassius Clay beating Sonny Liston. That's a really good observation that I've never really heard anybody make before. And
you can go on. I'm sorry, but you can go on. Like, you remember Duke beating UNLV, and everybody said, how did they do that? Well, look back on that. Duke A was easily the best team in college basketball the next year. They had three lottery picks on their team, which I think was more than UNLV had. It's just that's the kind of thing you don't really know at the time, and that's what it was. Michigan was a much better team in 1969 than anybody knew, and if they'd known how good they were, it wouldn't have been considered that big of an upset.
Hmm. One of the things that we follow as we read this book is how the players on these two teams, Ohio State and Michigan, in no way followed lock, stock, and barrel their two coaches in every single respect, and that there were certain players on these teams who had actually been in the military, and there were certain players on these teams who were tremendously sympathetic to the activists and so on. And that's, of course, one of the complexities of this era that we don't often stop to think about.
Yeah, and that's where really kind of this clash of being this conservative, militaristic coach in an increasingly liberal society, that's where it kind of really shows up, is Woody Hayes' 69 and his 1970 teams, they listen to everything he did. 1973, the team goes out before the Michigan game and just runs over and tears down the Michigan banner, which Woody never would have approved, but they didn't even tell him. They just went and did it. Every year it gets a little bit more difficult for him to kind of maintain control of his program and do it the way he wants to do it.
And you tell stories of how past players would come in to visit the locker room before a big game, and they would be just amazed at how the players of these later teams would be listening with such disinterest to what
yeah.
Woody Hayes was saying to them.
There's one scene in particular which was in spring practice in 1978 when a bunch of the players from the 1968 team, which is when the national title, come in. And the thing about Woody's players was they didn't really like him when they played for him. They were scared of him. But later they appreciated how great he was for them and how much he did for them. And so these guys are going in 10 years later thinking, hey, we're going to see these guys who were so scared, and then we're going to know that what he's doing to them right now is for in their best interest. And they go in, and the guy's slamming lockers, and they're not even whispering. They're actually talking to each other loudly, and Woody's just trying to talk over them, and he can't really do it. And they walk out and go, God, that was embarrassing. And one of them said, this is not going to end well. I mean, they could see it. So that's a change that they had to deal with. And with Bo Schembechler, if you go back a little earlier, in 1971, the official homecoming theme at the University of Michigan was, let's have a real homecoming, let's bring all the troops home. That was the official theme. And a bunch of his players signed a petition to end the war in Vietnam without his knowledge, and he just went crazy because that to him was a distraction. That was the kind of thing that could keep away from the football team, and that's what they had to deal with on a daily basis, was that fear that something like that could happen.
A couple of intriguing differences between Coach Hayes and Coach Schembechler. One of them, you say Bo Schembechler was one of the guys. Woody Hayes was never one of the guys.
That's right. And I think it's in that section where I say that, it was inconceivable that Woody Hayes would play golf. And in fact, when his assistant coaches would play golf, they would hide behind trees on the course because they thought he might spot them. I mean, that's how worried they were. He was all work all the time. Bo Schembechler would let his guard down. He'd make some self-deprecating jokes. He'd get close to his players and let them see his human side. And as a result, they felt very close to him. I mean, they loved him. The Ohio State players were kind of in awe of Woody. They felt like here's a guy who is working harder than anybody, who's an absolutist, who wants everything done exactly right. And when you're in awe of somebody, you can't really get close to them. And that was a big difference that I found between the Ohio State players and the Michigan players. They both admired their coaches tremendously. The Michigan players had lifelong friends with Woody. With the Ohio State players, there was a little bit of a distance there.
Hmm. Another interesting difference, you say one of Bo Schembechler's favorite mantras was the team, the team, the team, and he did not like to sort of put a spotlight on individual players who were stars. Woody Hayes, on the other hand, liked to talk about his star players.
Yeah, he did, and Archie Griffin in particular, who was the two-time Heisman Trophy winner, of course, he loved charting him out as sort of an example of what was right with the youth of America, sort of a model for how everyone else should be, and that was why he did it. He wanted people to see what good people were in the Ohio State football program. Bo did not want people to see the people inside the Michigan football program at all. He just wanted to see a winning team.
Hmm. Among the individuals whom we follow in this book is a player by the name of Mike Lantry.
Yes.
Just speak for a moment about who he was and why his story is especially compelling and why you felt that it was, in a sense, worth the time and space to follow him as closely as you do.
Well, he really plays an important role, I think, in this book and in telling this story, because you have all these people with these passionate political convictions, and here's someone who doesn't have those. And he's just kind of an innocent thrust in the middle of it, trying to do what was right for whoever, trying to do what was right for himself. And he starts the book, he's a soldier in Vietnam just trying to survive. I think like a lot of soldiers there, he wasn't in favor of the war, he wasn't opposed to the war, he was just fighting the war. And he ends up at the University of Michigan, and he decides to walk onto the team as a place kicker, and he really ends up viewed during his playing career, but also even as a soldier. I mean, when he comes back to campus, he's viewed the way people choose to see him. You know, they see that he was in the military. They find out. They may judge him for that. They find out that he's on the football team. They judge him for that. His success or failure on the field, and he plays a big role in a couple of critical moments in the games, he is judged for that. People see what they want to see with him, and I thought that was really interesting, sort of how somebody who didn't want to be involved couldn't help but just kind of get sucked into that. And everybody views him through the prism that he happens to be living in.
Hmm. Ultimately, the career of Woody Hayes comes crashing down, and actually in some ways bit by bit, as he increasingly seems to lose control of himself and his volatility. But then ultimately in that infamous moment, which I remember, not that I watched football all that devotedly back then, but for some crazy reason, I was watching that famous bowl game. What year was that again?
That was at the end of the 1978 season, December.
Right, where he actually hauls off and hits an opposing player that's intercepted a ball and run it back and is tackled on the Ohio State sideline, sealing the opponent's victory over Ohio State. And Woody Hayes just hauls off and hits this player. And the announcers, I remember that so vividly, missed it. And just suddenly there's this riot of swinging fists on the sideline. And they somehow missed the fact that the first punch was thrown by Woody Hayes. And in that instant, his career is over.
Right, and there's a couple of things about that that really, to me, say so much about the times. It was almost like a YouTube moment today, except it was early on, that it's caught on video, and it's so unusual that everybody just wants to see it again and again. The other thing is because ABC had not sprung for whatever, a few thousand bucks to have instant replay in that game. They couldn't show it again, and there was such skepticism of after Watergate that people really thought there was some kind of cover-up. And that just made it worse in its own way. I mean, they thought that this was being covered up and somebody had to expose it. So it really did say a lot to me sort of about the era and about how the country was changing. And at the start of this era that I write about in 1969, 1970, crafting an image really was not the priority for a lot of people. I mean, it certainly was not sophisticated in the way that it became. People were not using television in the way that they would. By the end, television is really the prism through which you're viewing everything, and I thought that kind of summed up. That's how people remember Woody Hayes, is that punch.
Hmm. You write this story now about Woody Hayes and Bo Schembechler at a time when they are both gone. They have both died. I'm sure, to some extent, that's a source of frustration for you, that it wasn't possible to sit down and engage the two of them face-to-face, and yet we can tell from reading your book that you were able to draw from a feast of conversations from all kinds of players and assistants who knew these two men well and in many cases were gladiators in this great conflict.
Yeah, you know, I did have a chance. Bo died in November of 06, and I started in 05, so I did have a chance to sit down with him a few times, not as much as I would have ultimately liked and had ultimately planned to do. Woody died in 1987, so that was not an option. But my feeling with Bo, even when I sat down with him, was he'd been telling Woody Hayes stories for 30 years. I didn't think he had a bunch of new ones, that he was waiting just for the right reporter to come ask him the right questions. So I was more there to bounce questions off of him. But being born in 1974 as I was, I think helped in a way, because I didn't have false memories of either of these two guys or of the era. And I really had to do my homework and go through newspaper stories and other books and interview players and get a real feel for who they were.
Hmm. One of the things you mentioned in the acknowledgments is that when you have larger-than-life figures like Bo Schembechler and especially Woody Hayes, stories spring up that in some cases are true and in some cases are not completely true and in some cases not true at all.
Right.
That has to be a little bit of a tricky challenge for you.
It's very tricky, and obviously as a journalist, I err on the side of, you know, not printing it if I don't know for sure. But one of those stories that I mentioned in those acknowledgments is in 1968, Ohio State went for two at the end of a 50-14 victory over Michigan. And Woody was supposedly said afterward, "Why'd you go for two?" "Well, because they wouldn't let me go for three." Well, one thing I found out for sure was that he did not want to go for two. That was something that happened without his knowledge, and it was kind of an accident, and he was not happy about it. The other thing is that I could not find anywhere in the next day's newspapers or in any of the stories leading up to the following year's game any reference to Woody Hayes saying they wouldn't let me go for three. Now, obviously, I can't definitively say he didn't say it. It's possible he said it to an alumni group or something, and Bo Schembechler, who had Ohio State ties, would have found out, but I couldn't find any evidence that he actually said it, and if you're asking me to guess, I think that's just one of those urban legends, a comment that people attributed to Woody that he probably never said.
Hmm. A last quick question. Under the acknowledgments, we see the name actually last of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Why is his name part of your acknowledgments?
Well, Woody was a huge Emerson fan, and people said that, you know, well, he loved Emerson, he'd quote Emerson, and that was really all anyone had written about it. And I felt like if he was so big on Emerson, to understand why, I ought to go read 500 pages of Emerson. And as I did that, it was eerie, because at times I could almost hear Woody Hayes' voice reading it. I mean, it was so similar to the things that Woody would say. And I made the decision to sort of sprinkle Emerson quotes throughout the book, hopefully for effect to kind of illuminate certain situations and make people realize how much of a part of Woody's coaching philosophy he really was.
Hmm. The book is fascinating. I enjoyed it start to finish. Again, it's called War as They Knew It, Woody Hayes, Bo Schembechler, and America in a Time of Unrest, published by Grand Central Publishing, the author Michael Rosenberg. Michael Rosenberg, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. This has been fun.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, one of my favorite interviews out of the archives with Oscar-winning actor Alan Arkin and his memoir, which is called An Improvised Life. The book not only recounts many memorable experiences from Alan Arkin's life and career, but also talks about the way in which improvisation, the craft of improvisation, has been incredibly important to him, both professionally and personally, and the way in which improvisation can and should and must be a part of all of our lives, whether we're actors or not. And on Friday, I'm sharing with you my interview with Paul Bester and his fascinating book called The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the World. He goes all the way back to the days of Jack Johnson and to more recent American